Thüringen in East Germany made history on the 1st of September. In state elections, the Alternative for Germany, or AfD, won more votes than any other party. The AfD is a far-right party whose leaders have been criticized and even successfully prosecuted for the use of Nazi symbolism and rhetoric.
For Germany, the first far-right party projected to win a state election since the Second World War.
The result has sent shockwaves around Europe. Sharing revolutions is a bit of a tradition on this continent. A touch paper, lit even by a single person, can start fires which eventually rage across many parts of the continent. 1848, 1917, 1933, 1968, 1989.
Poland, Hungary, and East Germany are telling the Soviets they want their troops out.
We want freedom, we want Ceausescu out.
And amid that shift, so much becomes suddenly possible. These are moments of reform and revolution that made modern Europe.
The people of East Berlin broke through the walls of their prison.
Substantial changes are coming.
But they've also been breeding grounds that have spawned our most brutal authoritarian leaders.
L'Ethiopia è italiana!
Und an dieser Stelle! Nur mit einem einzigen Gedanken, jetzt das zu verwirklichen.
And looking at the state of politics, as I do from where I live now in Vienna, conveniently in Europe's geographic centre, I think we're in another of these moments. So in this series, I'm going to be exploring and mapping these fault lines that are driving populist and authoritarian politics and putting democracy on the defensive. This is Continental Divides. Natalie Tocci is director of the Istituto Affari Internazionale in Rome and is riding shotgun with me throughout this whole series as a leading expert in European politics. Natalie, welcome.
Thank you, Misha. It's great being here.
Now, look, one thing I'm interested in, and it's what we're focusing on in this first episode, is the role of economics in all this, the economic crisis as a precursor, as it were. So how important is that economic background to the politics that we see today?
Well, I certainly think it was hugely important in what we could describe as the first wave of nationalist populism in Europe, which indeed was very much the product of the global financial crisis. In the second wave, which is in a sense very much where we're in today, it's in a sense economics, but as it's underpinned by the energy crisis and therefore the cost of living.
So to start, I want to go to a place that is both a good but unlikely candidate as the first domino in our game, Hungary.
In 2014, Viktor Orban spelt out his vision of Hungary as an illiberal democracy. We are searching for ways of parting with Western European dogmas, human rights, civil liberties, and a system of checks and balances.
Natalie, why is Hungary so important right now?
Hungary represents a model, the model of a country which is part of the West, it's part of the European Union, it's part of NATO, but it essentially acts as, in a sense, a spokesperson for a very different set of ideas and values compared to the values that underpin these organizations.
Viktor Orban is, depending on who you ask, Europe's bogeyman or the key to its salvation.
But he wasn't always a populist or illiberal leader. Once he was a moderate occupying the centre ground. But something apparently mundane helped to trigger a change in him. Mortgages.
My name is László Andor. I'm an economist. I'm Hungarian. I'm currently holding a position in the organization which is behind me, the Foundation for European Progressive Studies. The Hungarian case is an important episode, partly because it's an early example.
Okay, to set the scene, it's the 1990s, after the fall of communism. Hungary is heavily in debt, in part because of the weakness of its own currency, the forint. So the country invites as much outside investment as possible to bolster its foreign currency reserves. But this strategy comes with a few problems.
One is the side of let's say, financial vulnerability. And the second one is the political. When a lot of people realize that if this strategy remains for too long, control over the economy goes into foreign hands.
This came to a head in 2008, after the financial crash. The Hungarian forint was in free fall, but many financial institutions, originally set up as part of that foreign investment wave, were lending to ordinary Hungarians in foreign, now much stronger, currencies. For Hungarians earning their income in forints, the mortgage payments skyrocketed.
The credit sector became a time bomb.
Hungarians were suffering, but waiting in the wings, politically, was the man who would step into the breach.
We tell the truth and represent the truth, even if half the world attacks us for it.
Zsuzsanna Szelényi is a former politician. Now she's an academic. I asked her what the consequences of the mortgage crisis were for ordinary people.
A lot of people lost their houses. Hundreds of thousands of families were just not able to pay their debt. So obviously this contributed heavily for the success of Orbán's party, Fidesz, which was in opposition.
So the other government collapses, Orbán's elected prime minister. What does he do about the economic distress which so many Hungarians were suffering at the time?
He and his minister of finance wanted to create a growth-led economy. And he figured out that multinational companies should be then the ones who will pay the price of the crisis. And the Hungarian government introduced very high special taxes, which actually went against the European norms. And interestingly, these companies did all pay.
Orbán rapidly began restructuring the Hungarian economy.
Orbán decided quite early on that in order to ensure that he has a kind of complete run of his economic nationalist agenda, he would need to confront EU law. He would need to maybe not explicitly suspend checks and balances inside the country, but very seriously undermine the rule of law.
The whole constitution was changed in 2011 and ever since changed 14 times. So basically Orbán's government constantly changing the legal and constitutional environment to benefit his own political and business elite.
The effect on the media has been particularly pronounced.
If I was born in a Western European country or in the UK, I could have written 10 times more articles.
Szabolcs Pányi is an investigative journalist still working in Hungary.
Freedom of information or public information requests rarely work. Then we have to sue the government, then we have to wait years until we can get those documents that we wanted. And then, of course, there's the targeted campaign against journalists by the government. Sometimes they single out journalists and there are smear campaigns. Usually they try to portray as foreign agents. It's pretty much a copy-paste of what the Kremlin has been doing in Russia.
This crackdown is reflected at all levels of civil society, not just journalism, but the law, in business, academia, even football. At its heart lies the consolidation of Orbán's position as Hungary's undisputed master. And it all started with people being unable to pay their mortgages.
Leaders like Orbán, in a period in which, in a sense, an anti-establishment dynamic is very much present, standing against these things in and of itself garners quite a lot of popularity.
And we'll stay with Natalie for a moment now, because the second of our two examples for this episode is closer to home for her. Or, well, in fact, it's literally home for her. Italy. And the meteoric rise of Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, the leader of the far-right Fratelli d'Italia, or Brothers of Italy. How much of a shock is Meloni to the Italian system, Natalie? And how different is she, or not, to what's come before?
She's new in the sense that it is the first time that Italy has a prime minister that heeds from the neo-fascist past. Giorgia Meloni is not a newcomer. her party had been a coalition, a junior coalition partner in Silvio Berlusconi's government. And in fact, she herself had been a minister. So I think, you know, this is really a story of a normalization of the far right in Italy.
The Fratelli d'Italia was founded by Meloni and others in 2012. They were just a fringe part of Italy's large but fragmented right-wing coalition. In the general election in 2018, they took just 4.4% of the national vote. 4 years later, that had risen to 26%. And all of a sudden, they were the largest party in Italy. The key moment in Meloni's rise came against the backdrop of Italy's political response to economic crises generated by the COVID-19 pandemic.
For this virus is grinding Italy to a halt. Once buzzing, factories forced to close to stop the flow of people.
In the middle of the crisis, Mario Draghi, a highly respected administrator and politician, was appointed prime minister.
And he said, "This is a moment for national unity. I need all the parties to support me."
Luana Russo is an associate professor at Maastricht University and an expert on political polarization.
And nearly all parties supported him. Giorgia Meloni decided in a very strategic way to stay out of it, so she was the only party in opposition. She was way more free, right, to hold positions that were not in line with the government. The government also had to take decisions that weren't maybe super popular with everybody. This definitely created a sort of discontent with the current government, and Giorgia Meloni had a free hand in creating her own narrative.
This, then, is perhaps the core of the divide we're really talking about here. It's easy when the economy is booming to see the wealthy and the poorer, the boss and the employee, the foreign lender and the domestic borrower as all pulling in the same direction. But when the economy starts to crumble, reality hits. Some are still comfortable, others really aren't. Winners and losers. Opponents of Orbán and Meloni would argue that in both Italy and in Hungary, international institutions have played a huge role in rescuing their countries. The IMF did a lot to start the process of bailing out and stabilizing Hungary before Orbán was even elected. Since COVID, the EU has poured cash into Italy. But both Orbán and Meloni have seamlessly built those crises into a compelling narrative about the venality and elitism of the old order and the need for radical change. Across Europe, successive economic shocks, the financial crash, COVID-19, the invasion of Ukraine, have set the stage for a vastly more divided continent. But those mechanisms are not always simple and direct. And one way in which economics becomes politics is in emphasizing and deepening our geographic divides. The sense of a growing gulf between the countryside and cities, that's where we'll be going next. The background sound you're hearing is from a tiny village near the Bulgarian town of Gabrovo, several hours' drive from the capital Sofia. It's not a likely candidate if you're looking for the key to the future of Europe. You won't hear the chanting students of the Sorbonne as you did in 1968. Or the trains and rifles of the Red Army in 1919 as the revolution swept the Russian countryside. Instead, what you hear, mostly, is this. Silence. But for our moment in history right now, that silence is no less full of the promise of upheaval than the bangs and crashes of major revolutions. And that difference in sound tells a much bigger story about the widening chasm between people in rural areas and small towns and the vast metropolises of Europe. This is Continental Divides, and in this episode we're starting in Bulgaria because it's an extreme case. Bulgaria's rural areas are in steep and sustained decline, abandoned by young people, losing their economies wholesale. And that's where we sent our reporter, Borjana Jambazova.
It's shortly after dusk, and a choir of crickets is greeting us in Dragivtsi. It's all quiet. There's no square. There's no town hall. There's no shop or pub in this village. According to national statistics, it has a few dozen residents.
So, Borjana, where have all these people gone?
Well, Bulgaria is no exception from a global trend. People tend to move to big cities. But unfortunately, the picture is much grimmer in Bulgaria. For starters, Bulgaria is one of the countries with the fastest shrinking populations in the world. Bulgarian population back in 1989 was around 9 million people. Today, it's around 6.4 million people.
Hold it right there. That's an enormous drop. Why is that happening?
A lot of people left Bulgaria. There aren't that many babies being born, and we have a quite high mortality rate.
When you interviewed people in the area around Gabrova, what was their mood like? How do they perceive all that's going on in this way?
Obviously, many people were saddened by the fact that many villages are losing their population. Some of them are really becoming ghost towns. There is a sense of sadness and decline among people.
About a month ago, I headed north from Vienna to Warsaw and beyond, in fact, to the Lake District of Poland, which is an incredibly beautiful part of the world. I was going there because I'd been invited to a conference to meet Rafał Trzaskowski. Now, Rafał is a slick, smart, urbane politician who spent the last few years as the mayor of Warsaw. A symbol and a driver of the political change in Poland since last October, it's seen the liberal centrist party's civic platform wrest back power from the right-wing Law and Justice Party, or the PiS. But now, for the second time, he's gearing up to run for the presidency of all Poland, and he's widely tipped to win. If he does, it will complete a shift that will see him going from representing Poland's liberal capital to representing the whole country.
It's really striking that in many, many of the rural areas, they were voting for your opponents, the Law and Justice Party, PiS. Why is that?
Because rural areas are more conservative, but also because there is more and more sort of like social electorate, which is much more open to social policies and social handouts, which were prepared by the previous government. Of course, we need to engage and we need to change that, because at the end of the day, we also represent people from the rural areas and from the smaller cities. And we do have an idea how to represent their interests better.
Is there a danger that socially that division is going to further deepen, that you haven't yet found a way of bringing the two together?
So I would submit to you that Poland is developing quite evenly. And of course, our eastern regions, southern eastern regions, were quite underdeveloped compared to Warsaw. But now, I mean, we're catching up and there are less and less differences. The only problem is that, as everywhere in Europe, people are voting with their feet and young people are moving into the cities.
So the rural areas in that case are getting older, they're aging, and presumably with that they remain, if not they become, more conservative.
Well, yes, that is the case. But one of the miracles of Polish transition was that we devolved power. Half of the income tax you pay stay in your municipality, which means that when it comes to decision-making, quite a lot of decisions are taken by the local government.
Do you think that Poland is now on a track to bring the people together after, you know, a decade of very severe polarization.
When it comes to polarization, we observe polarization everywhere. And that's the fact of political life today. And of course, it is being exacerbated by the way in which new technologies, social media work. So we need to do something about that.
Now, in both Poland and Bulgaria, as for much of Eastern Europe, this rural-urban divide is particularly pronounced. It's a divide that separates not only villages from capitals, but big cities from smaller towns. However, this rural rebellion against domination from the centre is by no means confined to Eastern Europe. In recent years, we've seen massive protests, with, for example, the sight of German farmers driving tractors en masse up the autobahns to Berlin to take issue with tax changes. And more famously, of course, the Gilets Jaunes in Paris. And France is where we go for our final example today, where the politics of urban versus rural is simultaneously very present and very complex. If you've been to France, you'll know they pride themselves on their artisanal food culture, an image of the countryside prized in the boulangerie and charcuterie of every city. One French friend of mine told me even people who are born and raised in Paris will often find a way to trace their families back to the French countryside. My ancestors were winemakers in Bordeaux, you know, and so on.
I think there is a general dismissal of big cities who are in the collective imagination linked to insecurity, ugliness, sometimes being dirty, being very harsh on people, not having a lot of solidarity among people.
Cécile Aldoui is professor of French and Italian at Stanford University.
The devilish city that's going to corrupt the people. This comes from the 19th century French novel. And this romantic theme that emerged in novels was taken up by the far right at the end of 19th century to create this image of the unrooted. The people from the countryside, they are performing well, they're rooted in their soil, in their land. And when they're uprooted and going to the big city, they're destroyed and it creates all sorts of vices and corruption. Because some of the policies that have been proposed by the far right groups, it's to give subsidies specifically to young couples who would go and live on the countryside in rural areas to repopulate with typically French families the land.
The right's connection to blood and soil could be seen in this year's election too, with the president of the Rassemblement National, Jordan Bardella, making a point of speaking to farmers and rural communities. But the historic electoral success of the RN this summer can't be explained by the rural-urban divide alone.
I'm Safia Dahani. I am a PhD in political science. I've been working for the past 10 years on the French far right. For each territorial space, you need to understand the way the economy is in this space. You need to understand the past of the space.
In fact, Safia tells me it's the in-between spaces, not quite rural, not quite urban, that are driving the RN.
We have several studies about those, what we call peri-urban spaces. The way those spaces are characterized economically or via the lack of public services. They struggle to access the shops you need every day. They struggle to access to medical care. They have to take their car in order to move. People that want to flee their villages because they are being too close to the what is perceived as the ghettos where the immigrants can access public housing. But those people don't have the economic means. They are stuck between people that are too wealthy and people that are being perceived as too poor and that are reflecting on them.
I also spoke to Arnaud Dassier. He was a candidate in the last elections in France as part of the electoral alliance formed by the Rassemblement National.
Most of the wealth in France accumulates in Paris, mostly, and a little bit four or five other big cities, and that's it. The rest of the country is pretty poor.
What is it that the Rassemblement National offers rural communities that other parties don't?
The first thing they offer is respect, is the consideration. They talk about it. The people we're talking about, it looks like they don't exist in the public debate. They have been completely forgotten. And it's very symbolic of this problem that people can see that the state has left them, you know, physically. It's not there anymore. It's far away.
The Rassemblement National, of course, did very well in the first round of the elections. Why do you think beyond the rural areas, it also did very well in certain industrial areas and post-industrial areas of France?
Rassemblement National has been very successful in former industrial areas, which have been, you know, abandoned by economic wealth, and there are no jobs, and you can have the same kind of problems that you have in the rural areas. People can't bear it anymore, and they want solutions, they want actions. And that's why I think we will win in the end. It's because these problems are not going away.
France sees its politics as being close to a tipping point, with some very fragile political alliances frustrating, for the moment that is, the rise of the far-right Rassemblement National. The RN's broad base of support suggests they are capable of sweeping up a broad swathe of voters who feel left behind, betrayed by local changes in cities, suburbs, towns and villages across France. The wider the gaps become, the more people fall through them, and the more attractive radical populist solutions start to look. And there's nowhere that those solutions gain more traction than on one issue, possibly the most defining one we'll address in the whole series in the next episode: migration.
I arrived in Germany on the 4th of October 2015.
This is Zain Alamad. He's a young Syrian man who crossed the Mediterranean in 2015.
At the beginning, none of us could imagine how it looked like to be in Europe.
He was one of millions who crossed that year, fleeing war and persecution from across the Middle East, Central Asia and Africa.
People can just have a complete point of view about us, just for 1 minute talking or maybe just one look.
The arrival of migrants and refugees into Europe across our borders has become arguably the bitterest and most animating of our political rifts, with traditional political systems twisting themselves in knots as they try to balance humanity, the economy, and the growing anger that has become a sticky coating to the whole issue of migration. But can politically mainstream movements grapple with migration without betraying their own values? Or are we doomed to a world in which the far right uses migration as a wedge to split democracy itself wide open? For Zain, working nights as the far right surges in Germany, it's a terrifying moment.
I learned the language, I learned the rules, I respected the law, never made it trouble, but yet you're still saying, no, you are not integrated enough.
This is Continental Divides. Firstly, I want to bring in one of my expert guides, Gerald Knaus.
Well, I'm Gerald Knaus, and I'm based here in Berlin, running a think tank that looks at issues of European democracy, rule of law, and stability. In early September 2015, I listened to a speech by Viktor Orban. That was 2 days after the whole world had seen the images of Alan Kurdi, the small Syrian boy who had drowned. When the whole world was talking about empathy, and Orban said that the refugee crisis of 2015 was a huge opportunity. Europeans are going to want control. They're not going to get control from those hypocritical liberals. And that will mean a profound shift in European politics.
For Gerald Knaus, the key trick the far right has pulled is to muddy the waters.
So you mix it all together. Loss of control, changing demography, a need for migration which isn't really acknowledged or openly talked about, And then migration and Islamophobia. And you have a potent brew, or you basically have an explosive in the hands of gifted populists.
My other expert European guide is Natalie Tocci from the Istituto Affari Internazionale in Rome. Natalie, what do you make of Gerald's thesis about these jumbled categories?
The paradox in all this has been that in moments in which irregular migration has been going up, there has been this securitized approach in figuring out ways of containing it. And then I think the other twist to this is the nexus between irregular migration and regular labor migration.
To our first example, Denmark, where the center-left Social Democrats reign supreme, but have, in recent years, lurched radically to the right on the question of immigration. Bo Lidegaard is a Danish historian, former senior civil servant, and former newspaper editor of Politiken. I asked him to talk me through the background to this sea change.
We had, like many other European countries, many immigrants coming in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And there was a debate on whether these were just socially exposed and poorly integrated, socially vulnerable groups, or whether the fact that they came with a different culture made this integration process fundamentally different from the big waves of immigration that we have always experienced. And in the Danish Social Democratic Party, the first interpretation dominated, and the result was a rapidly growing extreme right or national right that basically cannibalized half of the Social Democratic Party until it shifted 10, 15 years ago to the interpretation that immigration into Denmark, especially Muslim immigration, in big numbers, mattered in ways that requested a different attitude, and that you could not integrate those coming if you did not control the numbers.
For the Social Democrats, the political gamble paid off to a degree, certainly electorally, because in the 2022 election they won 28% of the vote, which was their best result for 20 years. And the far-right surge was also blunted. But it came at a cost. Like most of the continent, Denmark is aging, and like the rest of Scandinavia, it has a well-developed and expensive welfare state funded by high taxes on high wages. And there's a broad economic consensus that migration has to come back up so that Danish companies can recruit the workers they need to pay the taxes to fund the welfare state. Natalie Tocci, what do you take away from the Danish example?
In many respects, you can look at Denmark as, in a sense, being the precursor of a trend in social democracy, which is actually beginning to spread, I would say, amongst Sweden's social democrats, Finnish social democrats, and in fact, German social democrats. Let's look at what's happening in Germany at the moment, where social democrats Chancellor Olaf Scholz is sort of really cracking down on migration. I think it's the entire political spectrum in Europe that has really shifted on this question.
In Austria, where I live now, we have seen politics upended by migration. Refugees have come to Austria in really large numbers in the last 10 years, especially given it's not a huge country. And as Gerald Knaus points out, it takes in more refugees per capita than anyone else in the European Union. The political impact has been, well, typical and predictable. The Austrian far right has surged.
The anti-immigration Freedom Party has come first in Austria's parliamentary election.
The Russia-friendly FPO has twice served in previous coalitions.
The furthest to the right, they're no further to the right of the FPO.
So but there's a quirk in this phenomenon. Cities like Vienna have absorbed the vast majority of the newcomers, and they've stayed liberal on the issue. The further you get outside the big cities, the less likely you are to meet migrants. But there is where you start to see posters and signs for the FPÖ. It's a reminder here that when you zoom out, causation looks simple. But when you zoom in, it becomes much messier.
My name is Tessa Szyszkowitz, and I'm a correspondent for the Viennese weekly Falter.
Why have we seen this resurgence in support for the Freedom Party in Austria?
We are a little bit in a trend in Europe now with xenophobia and the fear of immigrants. And, you know, we have also a recent wave of stabbings with knives in Vienna. So all these things play in similar like in Germany and also in France, that people are scared and they resort to simple solutions being offered by the far right also here in Austria.
Could it be perhaps that in Herbert Kickl, the leader of the Freedom Party, they've found somebody who's much more effective as a leader than previous ones, certainly in the past 10 years or so?
I'm not sure that he's effective. I think he's very clear in how he talks to people. He's a very talented politician in that sense. And what is really remarkable about him is that he coined the phrase that the law should follow politics and not politics should follow the law.
Is there any difference between the Freedom Party in Austria and the Alternative for Germany, the AfD in Germany?
Well, none of these parties are the same or identical. In general, they are going after the same voter. The voter that is scared, feels left behind, wants to kick foreigners out.
Germany's politics in the modern era has a reputation for being thoughtful, slow, boring even, with the major parties too often in coalition together to become bitter public enemies. But let me tell you, right now, it's on fire. It's losing its mind, and debates over migration are driving the chaos.
From today, Germany will be implementing new border checks that will remain for the next 6 months as the country attempts to curb the influx of illegal migrants.
Roiling Germany right now is the rise of the AfD, not in the country as a whole, but specifically in eastern Germany, the areas that were once on the Soviet side of the Berlin Wall. Gerald Knaus again.
You really have not one but two countries. The five states of East Germany, those are the bits of Germany with the lowest number of foreigners. I mean, East Germany, what you see, is really a mixture of not being used to foreigners in the way West Germans were, not knowing many foreigners and being particularly afraid of Muslims, everything mixed up with distrust of liberal elites. And they are, to be honest, mainly Western. You know, there has been a takeover after unification of East Germany by Western bureaucrats and politicians, and there is resentment.
The East, for historical reasons, having lived under socialism as long as it did, has got a much, much larger proportion of working class people in it than the West does. So there are economic reasons that underpin this whole trend.
Katja Hoyer was born in East Germany and is the author of Beyond the Wall, a new social history of the East that argues that stereotypes of life under communism have led to a persistent chasm of understanding between East and West.
So people are really averse to migration despite the fact that they haven't got any immigrants in the village or in their community. I've just been travelling through Brandenburg, which is the state around Berlin. You know, there's hardly any immigrants there, and yet it's a massive issue. I think the fear is that things might change, and that's for an issue with migration as well as the economy and everything else. People feel that their communities and the way that they were aren't the same anymore. It was easier for a long time to just say the Easterners are still weird because they've had this dictatorship experience and so now they're looking for authoritarian options. I've always thought that the East is simply ahead for economic and social reasons of a trend. West Germany, I would say, is the outlier when you look at the rest of Europe. I think taking some of these really uncomfortable issues like migration, social change, and those sorts of things, and bringing them out into the open and discussing them, whether that's, you know, something that the political mainstream wants to do or not, these discussions are happening. They're just not happening out in the open, and that, I think, is quite dangerous.
That is why we need to offer solutions. Solutions that restore a sense of control and honesty about what we can't control and why we don't control it. We will not get back to societies where there are no Muslims. But that's not the end of the world. You know, that's like Vienna in 1918, when suddenly you had Jews. You had no Jews in Vienna until 1860. And suddenly, 10% of the population was Jewish and they were very visible. And you had crazy people saying this is the end of the world. We know how that ended. it must not be the same with the current attacks on another minority that is about the same proportion of the population. You know, you have a leader in Thuringia, Höcke, who talks about Germany needs to expel a fifth or a quarter of its population. These are not jokes.
All of the divides in this series touch in the end on this issue, partly because when almost any divide festers, there will always be an opportunity for political gain by stoking resentment towards migrants at the margins. And the more Europe divides internally, the weaker it becomes to external threats. And in case you hadn't heard the news from the Eastern Front, we're currently facing a pretty big one. In the next episode, I'm off to Ukraine.
I do not want us to lose our people's minds, and now I feel like we are losing them.
Irina Zhluktenko is the founder of Dziga's Paw, a charity that brings tech to Ukraine's armed forces. I met her in the city of Lviv in western Ukraine.
I want everyone to feel like we have to do something, we have to fight to make it end.
Only 24, but with an iron resolve, Irina regularly travels to the front line to drop off equipment like drones and portable power packs to support Ukraine's frontline soldiers.
And tell me, what is it like traveling to the front line?
Every time it's scary, of course. And I can give an example of my classmate. He's now a drone pilot. The last time we visited him was in June, and I just could feel he was really exhausted. And he didn't have any more, like, emotions left.
When Russia launched its full-scale attack on Ukraine in 2022, it brought about a moment of unity. But now many of the far-right parties currently rising in Europe openly challenge the scale of aid to Ukraine. And they call for peace talks with Russia that will almost certainly see Ukraine sacrifice sovereign territory. So far, this hasn't been a wildly popular position, but as cracks appear elsewhere, questions arise about what happens next. This is Continental Divides.
2.5 years into the war in Ukraine, we're looking at something resembling a stalemate.
Shashank Joshi is The Economist's defense editor.
Russia is pounding Ukraine with missile strikes. Ukraine is hitting back on a smaller scale. This conflict is something of a contest of wills. It's a war of attrition.
Ukrainian officials argue that continued support from its allies is more important than ever. Loss of momentum now could tip the balance in Russia's favor. And support has been coming in from the US as well as closer to home.
Emmanuel Macron said Western support for Kyiv would not weaken.
And the UK says it will provide Ukraine with 650 new lightweight missiles.
But while military assistance is clearly vital, political support is too. So to our first example, and for me as a former Central Europe correspondent for the BBC, it's a story that feels quite close to home, Serbia, where Russia has long been seen by many as a friend and ally.
March 2022, just days since Russia launched a full-scale invasion, a mural of the Russian president Vladimir Putin appeared in Vrapča, one of central districts of Belgrade.
Jovana Georgievski is a BBC reporter based in Belgrade, Serbia. Jovana is walking around the city she calls home, seeing how discussions that happen at the highest level of international politics can be splashed across the streets, quite literally.
On way to work, I sometimes walk past this wall. Originally, a pro-Russian author wrote the word brat, Serbian for brother, next to the image of Putin. But if you take out the first letter, you get rat, Serbian word for war. Pro-Ukraine activists soon painted over the first letter, changing the message.
When I read reports in the media about Serbia, they often say that Belgrade has long historical friendship and alliances with Russia. And many people accuse the president, Aleksandar Vučić, of being Putin's right-hand man in the Balkans. I asked the Serbian political scientist Ivan Vejvoda if this is really true.
No, not at all. In fact, I would say that it's completely misleading to portray Serbia in that way. Serbia has consistently voted in the United Nations, accusing Russia of aggression. And the other thing is, Serbia contributes significantly to Ukraine's war effort.
But yet, when you walk around Belgrade, I have to say you see a lot of photographs and posters of Putin and pro-Russian sentiment, including coming from the president's own party. So how do we explain that? It seems to me weirdly odd, this.
Yes, it's an important question you raise. In opinion polls that I would call superficial, but nonetheless they are opinion polls, when Serbs are asked, do you like Putin, do you like Russia, you get a clear majority of 60-65%. But when you ask any other question, you know, where do they like to travel? Where would they send their children? Where would they otherwise like to live? These are all pro-Western answers.
So on that superficial level, as you described it, the 65%, what is driving that sympathy for Putin amongst the Serbian population?
Well, there are several reasons. One is the fact that Serbia, or rather then the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, was bombed by NATO in 1999 for 78 days. Putin, to put it colloquially, pokes the eye of the West, and we like when someone pokes the eye of those who bombed us.
Is Serbia going to ever decide which side of the fence it's going to come down on?
Well, the first thing to say is that the strategic direction of Serbia wanting to join the European Union has always been reiterated. Serbia has very close relationships with NATO. In fact, it has more military exercises with NATO than with anyone else. So in that sense, I think there's a clarity of direction. But there's always this question, why isn't Serbia decoupling politically from Russia? Serbia is the only country that hasn't imposed sanctions on Russia. I said this temptation to be, in a way, with big quotation marks, non-aligned. So we'll see what happens in the coming years. I think it's becoming more difficult to sit on the fence than it used to be.
States often find themselves being pulled in directions that ultimately betray where their loyalties really lie. Leave Belgrade, head north, and in just under 2,000 kilometres, you'll reach another country which understands the dilemma of neutrality extremely well.
So picture yourself as growing up and being told that as part of your identity as a nation, as a citizen, you don't take side.
Nima Korami is a research associate at the Arctic Institute based in Stockholm.
And then all of a sudden, the government decides that it's the time to join a military alliance.
So to all Swedes, I say, velkommen till NATO, welcome to NATO.
That created sort of a bit of a shock amongst especially the left-leaning parties. So it was a bit of an identity clash.
Sweden's decision to abandon its long-standing, much-cherished principle of neutrality was the third in a line of three dominoes. The first was Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The second was Finland joining NATO, another neutral country.
You know, it was a wake-up call in a sense that, like, Finland has always been this buffer between Russia and Sweden. So by defending Finland, Sweden is essentially defending itself. The best way to contribute to the defense of Finland, if Finland is in NATO, is by Sweden being in NATO as well. If you talk to defense officials, if you talk to officials in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, there is no question about the importance of maintaining and strengthening Sweden's alliance and partnership with the United States. But at the same time, there has always been this concern about US's hegemonistic wars in the Middle East and, you know, Asia. Similar concerns are echoed about, you know, the history of countries like the UK and France, given their colonial past.
And it's not just the politics outside of NATO, but within it too, that could pose a problem.
NATO is not just a selective security sort of organization, but it's also a political actor. There is a lot of policy-making processes that are essentially influenced by national interests and objectives of different member states. And that will inevitably have consequences for foreign policy decision making in Sweden. There is a concern among certain segments of the public and politicians that Swedes may not feel comfortable to be involved in all sorts of NATO activities. What if Sweden has to contribute to the security of less democratic member states of the NATO? Are Swedes prepared to have American nuclear weapon on the Swedish soil? So these are the questions that Swedes have, they're concerned about, but I think I wouldn't read too much into it, provided that the government actually starts having open debates about these issues. Because for instance, on the question of like sending Swedish troops to, you know, regions outside Europe, it has already happened. Like Sweden was involved in Afghanistan, was involved in Libya. So I think there is definitely room for more public debate. You could say, speak the truth to the public that, look, we've never been neutral. What we've been pursuing is selective alignment.
Russia's invasion and annexation of Crimea in 2014 had already precipitated a change in NATO.
Shashank Joshi again.
But I think that it was Russia's full-scale invasion, really what in Germany was described as the Zeitenwende, the turning point. Defence spending has gone up more dramatically still. Countries are now considering the reintroduction of conscription. And perhaps most importantly of all, NATO as an alliance has drawn up the first comprehensive regional defence plans that they have had since the Cold War. And that's a huge step change in the psychology of the alliance. And in that sense, Russia's invasion of Ukraine was the shock therapy that finally woke the continent up from that long post-1989 slumber that it was in.
Natalie Tocci is director of the Istituto Affari Internazionali in Rome and one of my expert guides accompanying me through this whole series. I asked her if she agreed with Shashank's assessment that Europe's attitudes towards defence and security have fundamentally changed.
Looked at from Brussels outwards, what has happened over the last few years is really quite revolutionary. However, if you look at it from a sort of outside-in perspective, here we are, the European continent is at war. Are we actually doing what is necessary? The fact that if we exclude the UK and Norway, 27 of the richest countries in the world can cough up as much ammunition in 1 year as North Korea can vis-a-vis Russia. So if you look at it from sort of that broader perspective, then you think, okay, fine, yeah, a lot's been done. But frankly speaking, it's still baby steps compared to what we have to do.
Are we actually doing what is necessary? Necessary means avoiding any further outbreak of war, preventing the loss of life, freedom, and sovereignty. Compared to some of the other divides we've talked about this series, this one is developing more in real time, a crack that we might not notice yet until the whole surface shatters. For our Ukrainian neighbours like Irina Zhluktenko, there's no need to imagine what this might be like.
Since the beginning of the full-scale invasion, my younger friends died, and I'm now 24, and they were like 24 to 25. It means back in 2014, when the war started, they were all like 14, 13, 15 years old. We were teenagers, and it's sad, but it's my motivation to just do not forget about their sacrifice.
Almost every country on the European continent has, in just about living memory, experience of this happening. And even as time goes on and the people who have direct experience of these things become fewer and fewer, memories of our past persist and continue to define us. And that's what I want to explore in the final episode of the series, The Memory Wars. I'm doing one of my favourite things in Vienna, which is to sit in a cafe. And I've been joined by my friend Ruth Vodak. How would you describe yourself, Ruth?
Well, I'm a discourse analyst and sociolinguist.
Ruth, we're in quite a special square here in the center of Vienna. What's this strange monument next to us?
Well, this square is called Judenplatz, which means the square of Jews. The strange monument is a monument to the victims of the Holocaust. Luckily, some people have learned history and many, of course, not.
In this series, I've been concerned with the nagging feeling that history across Europe might be repeating itself. Europe has a history of authoritarianism and a history of conflict, but it also has a long, proud tradition of pulling itself back from the brink. The memory of Hitler and Mussolini still sends shivers down our spines. Less so Oswald Mosley, though, or the French fascist leader Charles Maurras, or the Polish fascists, the Endecja under Roman Dmowski. But what we remember and how we remember it, this is not purely an academic question. As different political movements vie to wrest control of the continent's future into their own hands, they do so against backdrops of stark contrast in how they talk about the past. This is Continental Divides. In many European countries, the debate over the past bubbles under in the background, shaping and informing other debates. But there's only one country that stands out for having exposed the whole iceberg: Spain. Giles Tremlett was for many years the Guardian's correspondent in Madrid. He's also the author of one of the most influential books in any language about Spain's memory wars, Ghosts of Spain. Giles, November the 20th, 1975, I was walking down Friedrichstrasse in East Berlin, and they had this big electronic ticker in Friedrichstrasse, and I suddenly saw the news: Spanish dictator Franco dead. What happened in Spain after the Spanish dictator Franco died?
Spain actually transformed itself into a democracy very rapidly. But at the same time, something lived on which had been part of the basis of the transition to democracy. And that was a silence about the past. It just wanted to look forward. And obviously, below that feeling is a sense of fear, shall we say. And it really started with a few cases of people who were buried in mass graves, who had been shot by death squads, basically, during and just after the Civil War. A few of those graves began to be dug up in the early 2000s.
The work of unearthing the Francoist past is not metaphorical. We visited an archaeological dig in Paterna, Valencia.
I'm Arantxa Janssen. I'm an archaeologist. And I work actually in Archaeoantro, that is a scientific association. And here we have almost 2,237 persons that they were murdered in the Francoist repression. When the families arrive to the massive graves, it's a very emotional moment for us. Share with them the pain and the happiness at the same time is the most human thing we can do.
My name is Nicholas Marquez Grant. I am an associate professor at Cranfield University in the UK, and I teach forensic anthropology, which is the examination and analysis of human remains. And in most cases, what we're finding are gunshot wounds to the back of the head or another parts of the skeleton. Some of the remains do have personal belongings. Sometimes it's a ring, say it's a wedding ring, or it's a wallet with a photograph. And these objects sometimes are given back to families and are really powerful. Personally, I have a great-grandfather who's missing. To my grandmother, basically her father was taken when she was about 8 years old and shot and then buried in a clandestine grave. She never told me this. She never told me that she had a father and actually a sibling that were executed. And I tried to speak to her about this when I started working, and she never told me anything about it. She told me to be quiet. So basically, from a more personal point of view, people are buried, they're abandoned in a way, but I think it's important to bring them back.
Giles Tremlett again.
There are history wars in Spain, and they're very much flavoured by the political beliefs of one side or the other. And yes, it did cause a terrible ructions in small villages where people remembered who the dead were. They remembered who the killers were. So it was very much, you know, a living thing. You know, what did my father or uncle do to your mother, father or uncle? So I think maybe people have got a bit more used to it. And that's maybe, you know, the positive part of what's happened. The whole silence around what's happened has gone away.
So I think in the case of Spain...
Natalie Tocci has been by my side this whole series as our expert guide, the director of the Istituto Affari Internazionali in Rome.
Yes, you know, you turn the page on dictatorship and you transition to democracy. But essentially, the system itself was never defrancoized. Now that Spanish politics has, in a sense, polarized more, you see it resurfacing up. But I think the bottom line is that, let me say, purging, if you like, of those elements never really happened.
Across Europe, there are a number of memory wars. But if you want to find the place deepest in the mire, you need to head to the Balkans, where the legacy of the Second World War is caught up between fascism, communism, competing nationalisms, driving not only internal political divides, but also external diplomatic regional conflict. It's a place I know well, having covered the wars of the 1990s there as the BBC's Central Europe correspondent. Driving the crises in this region has been the competition and mistrust that sporadically breaks out between Serbia and Croatia. When it does, it can be brutal. And the legacy of those traumas is bound up with one place in particular, Jasenovac.
The crimes were committed at Jasenovac, called the Auschwitz of the Balkans. 80,000 died between 1941 and 1945.
The camp was set up by the Nazi-affiliated Ustasha regime during World War II.
Murdered tens of thousands of Serbs, Jews and Roma people.
I'm Sibel Rola, daughter of Dragan Rola, who survived 3 years in the Jasenovac concentration camp in Croatia. My parents died within 18 months of each other, and they lived in Zagreb at the time. I remember that there was a storeroom in the basement of the apartment building where my parents lived. I dug around some more, pages and pages of typed manuscript, handwritten manuscript on gossamer thin pages. And I started reading completely at random. I realised at that point that this was writing about his time in the Jasenovac concentration camp. I felt it was my duty to put it down on paper. And I'd like to read from that now briefly. Unastup, roll call, they yelled as we fell into ranks. We stood shivering in a row. Faster! What are we doing today? The guard sniggered. Every fifth or tenth, they need to be punished. Every tenth, the officer in front screamed. One, two, three, the guards counted. Your mates have tried to escape. Four, five, six. This is to teach you a lesson, you filthy animals. Seven, eight, nine. It is impossible to escape from Jasenovac. Not even a bird can escape. Remember that. Tenth, kneel. A crack and a thud. I flinched. A dark shape rolled sideways to the ground. The smell of cordite filled the compound. And then it started all over again. They were getting closer. One, two, three. My heart pounded like a drum inside my ears. Four, five, six. The counting continued. A shadow dashed past me and ran towards the barbed wire fence. Another ear-splitting pop of the gun. They shot number seven in the back. Shuffle up, the rest of you. Stomach heaving, I counted with them. Was I ninth or tenth? Where were we? Seven, eight, nine, ten. Kneel, another crack. The man next to me slumped to the ground. Did the comrade on the barbed wire save my life? I didn't even know his name. I feel that in Croatia, too many people are trying to hide what happened. during World War II in Jasenovac.
The distortion of traumatic pasts and the manipulation of traumatic pasts opens the path for new cycles of violence.
Vjeran Pavlakovic is the chair of the Department of Cultural Studies at the University of Rijeka.
The memory politics regionally has become even more aggressive. The distortion that nothing happened there feeds and fuels right-wing Croatian nationalism. The idea that millions of people were killed here only because they were Serb by fanatical Croats, that fuels extreme Serb nationalism. It is a political question. It's not just ancient history.
Ivo Goldstein has lived through these battles time and again. He's now in his 60s and the doyen of historians who have explored the Holocaust and its outgrowths in the region. He spoke to me from Zagreb.
About 120,000 to 130,000 people have entered Jasenovac system of camps. The final number of, let's say, some 80 to 100,000 victims.
In terms of Croatia itself, Croatian society, was there a debate about Jasenovac and how Jasenovac should be remembered?
There is a constant debate about the nature of Jasenovac. New generations who are coming do not have adequate education in the schools, are not longer linked with the culture of memory about the Second World War. All these problems which we have, which are not only Croatian problems, but European problems, I think that we are losing the battle. I think that in the last couple of years, the situation has deteriorated even, and it's becoming worse and worse. The position of the Croatian government, now almost official, is that the Ustasha didn't commit the genocide against the Serbs, but only the mass crimes have been committed by the Ustasha against the Serbs, which I think is unacceptable and it's horrible. The real reconciliation between the countries and the people can happen only by becoming fully aware of the bad episodes in the national history. It's not happening in Croatia, it's not happening in Serbia.
Across Europe, the past is fighting a rearguard action against politics. But as we file it alongside the records of all these fault lines, the rifts that constitute our divided Europe, it's the one that poses the most important question. In 20 years, 50, 80, 100 years, how will this moment be remembered?